Vande Mataram. So, the subject for today is Sri Aurobindo's vision of India. Though it is under the larger umbrella of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, so we'll probably open it to a wider field. And I think given today's context, it may be good to take it up as certain questions and answers. For the moment, I'll raise the questions. Questions which I think all of us raise to ourselves, and we should raise to ourselves. Because questions open the door to progress. Any society which becomes unquestioning becomes stagnant. And to stagnate may preserve a society for some time, but sooner or later it declines, because this is the law of nature. So I know, I think everyone gets what I am hinting at. A society which doesn't progress, today or tomorrow, it's going to decline. So we may say that, well, we have been progressing. At least we are a progressive society. And perhaps the answer would be yes and no. It is yes in the sense that we have not remained stuck to the past ways of life in certain sense. And we have progressed along the lines of the Western development. But it's no, because from the point of view of the spiritual and creative force that India had manifested, the fact remains that we are still too much in the past. Not that the past is not good, it's wonderful, there is no doubt about it. But we are too much into the past and not yet creating new forms for the future. It's so important. Somebody was recently speaking about the ashram and how the mother writes that at one point of time in 1957, she says that now ashram is no more confined or limited to the physical space that we know as the ashram. She says it has become a true collectivity where she has joined, of course, with her own threads, all those who have declared in their heart that they are disciples of Sri Aurobindo. She says just they have declared within themselves, in their heart. They are not proclaiming, nothing. And she says that there is a new collectivity which has formed around it. So many people didn't understand it and they felt that this is going to bring down the level of consciousness of the ashram. She said momentarily it may seem so, but in the larger sense, it is going to grow, because it's like more people are beginning to evolve. And then she says something very important. She says that this was necessary if the ashram had to remain viable. Almost saying that if it remained confined to that little geographical space. Geographical space is there, it is the center. But ashram is not confined only to this small space. And this is happening very naturally, spontaneously. And I think this is an aspect we all need to understand. Something like this probably happened in India. Not only probably, it did happen in India, which we have to understand our fault lines if we really want to bring things together. And one of the fault line was that for whatever reasons, good reasons, just like ashram at one point of time was not porous. You know, you just couldn't come easily. And I mean, physically you can come, but you're not like anybody can walk into and have darshan of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, or just become an ashramite immediately. Even now there are difficulties, but a lot more flexibility is there. So in India at one point of time, the need to preserve the sacredness and the knowledge was given in the hands of few. And it was a very good combination at that point of time in the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. And the Brahmins had nothing or very little to do with surname. They had more to do with, they were custodians of knowledge and they transmitted it not just by word of scripture but by the knowledge which they had acquired. And it was the force of knowledge, the Brahmatej, that made somebody a Brahmin. And along with Brahmatej, you need the Kshatratej to preserve it. So that it was the kings who had to ensure that this seeking after knowledge, all this is preserved. So this was the way that knowledge was kept intact for a long, long time, for maybe a few millenniums. But then what happened? There was a whole section which was deprived of this. So they were given another kind of understanding, sometimes symbolic. And slowly, as happens when a system is turned into too rigid a form, is given too strict a form, that it begins to decline. So these peripheral elements, deprived of the true knowledge, they began to, ultimately, you know, nature finds way, they went their own way. They became, as one place Sri Aurobindo says, they became very irreligious. It's very strange because they had their own way of life. Even if you look at it during the time of Chandragupta Maurya and earlier, and when people become that, they become more and more self-centered, selfish. Whereas there were these custodians who were there, but they also became, over a period of time, arrogant by that virtue that I am the king and I am the Brahmin priest. And it led to internally a division within the society. And we must be very careful that we don't repeat the same mistake. Now the times are different and yoga has to be generalized. It has to be given to the whole of mankind. We can't deprive people simply because there is, of course, the inner adhikar. But even that nowadays, Sri Aurobindo says that in ancient times, inner adhikar was important. But now, over a period of time, things have evolved, times have changed, and we have to keep pace with that. And I remember, even as a child, in my own place where I grew up as a Brahmin, but it was regarded that any Pandit has to be respected. And it used to strike me as something very odd, because when you look at the character, when you look at their ways of life, you felt he is not a person who is worthy of respect. And I'm sure many people have gone through it, but curbed it. Now we don't use that terminology anymore. I think so, that nobody says he's a Pandit, therefore you touch the feet. But therefore there was this slow decline. And then what happened? The Kshatriya Tej also diminished the kings. There was a further division between the kings, and the kings had to be exemplars. And we know that the Brahmins, this division became more and more palpable. And Brahmins, devoid of power, preserved the knowledge, but preserved it all within the mind. So one of the problems that we see in Indian society, and Sri Aurobindo hits it right there in his pamphlet of Bhavani Bharti, he says, we have bhakti. We have no, and bhakti is wonderful. Yes, I mean, some people start deriding, it's wonderful. As an individual progress, bhakti is really one of the shortest ways to the divine. But bhakti without seva, without shakti, that is something which is not good for the society as a whole, not good for the civilization as a whole. So one was that we have had bhakti, we have bhakti. We also have jnana. Even today, so many debates over the types of, you know, what does Vedanta really mean? We have so many talks and so many things organized, ways through which the Vedanta, Vedantic teaching, the Vedantic doctrine is taught. But where did the gap take place? It didn't percolate in life. So this is so important, that Vedanta is nothing if it is not lived. As that's why Sri Aurobindo, when he speaks about Indian resurgence, he says, recover the Aryan thought, not just in the mind, but also in life. So teachings are there, but they are not lived. And there are several examples which I don't want to go into. For instance, nowadays Ramayana is going on. We have Lord Ram, and you know how he has dealt with, he has shown the path of dharma. If you see Ramayana and Mahabharata together, every aspect of dharma has been very beautifully revealed there. And we all have Ramayana Saptas, we all have Bhagavat Saptas. But when it comes to practice in our own life, with regard to wife, children, with regard to society at large, we are very, very far from that ideal. It's a stark contrast. So if a society has to change, it must first begin to look inside very sincerely. And we have a great past, without a doubt about it. But we have to also understand that if you have to go into the future, we have to live. Truth is nothing if it is not lived. That's why in the ashram we have that wonderful thing of the mother. When you come in the beginning, it hits very hard. And then slowly it sinks. And she says a drop of practice is much more useful, maybe better, than an ocean of theories, resolutions and good advices. So we are experts at giving advices, often unwanted advices. So, but to live the teaching. For example, just in the modern context. Now, I am touching upon the crisis in Bangladesh. All this is happening. People are giving a suggestion. What is the suggestion? Oh, ask the Hindus to come back. We'll take them into the fold. What kind of teaching is this? I really don't understand. The teaching should be, let's flood it there and face the enemy and the danger. Let's awaken Durga. Today morning I was just putting on Durga Chandi part and saying, may all this go to Bangladesh and may they be awakened. A true Hindu, he doesn't run away from battle even if the odds are completely against. That's not Hindutva. The Hindu race is leonine and we have forgotten that. One lion, even against a bunch of wolves, and you see one thing I must say, the perpetrators of the crime in Bangladesh, what happened in Pakistan, the demographic shift, we keep crying. But what's the use of crying? Even in Kashmir, why it all took place? We fell, as Sri Aurobindo says, for want of Shakti. Bhakti is there, Jnana is there. Shakti is not there. Hindu doesn't believe in reality of death. He believes in laying down his life if necessary for Dharma. And I was sharing this with someone and I can say this. See, the Islamic forces always, you'll see two things very clearly. I'm saying this very openly. One is deceit. Second is power of mass and trying to create a, what is called in Hindi as a hawa, terrorizing you by deceit and many. But at heart, people who are very violent of this nature, who try to play victim, are extremely cowardly. This is something we have not realized, the fault line. Look at Bangladesh lesson. 93,000 soldiers surrendered. And why they surrendered? Simply because they got this idea, we are surrounded from every side. What kind of an army is this? And that is trained army. So they always do this tactics of hiding, taking the peak and from there hiding inside the den and shooting bullets or suddenly entering into, walking into, you know, what kind of a, we can see, terrorist acts. Because they are extremely weak and cowardly. One day, the day we realize our own strength. I am reminded of the story of Sri Ramakrishna where he took the lion who was with the sheep, grew up with the sheep, to the river stream and said, look into this river. Why are you bleating like a goat or a sheep? And when he saw, he sees that I am same as the lion who has attacked. And then he says, as Swami Vivekananda says, now you roar. We swear by Swami Vivekananda. But look at Swami Vivekananda. How leonine he is. If one quality that comes across him, that when he goes to Chicago and, you know, he's the underdog most people have. And when he speaks with that full gusto and he doesn't care, you know, what, how people will. I mean, he's flowing. And to that extent, he had such a courage that at one point people asked him about Sri Ramakrishna. And as he started saying, he realized that, because, you know, you understand the mind of the people, that they are not quite connecting with it, because he was full of love for his master. Suddenly, midway, he stopped and said, I don't think you deserve to know about him. Walked away. Not that, you know, oh, I should speak, complete the speech, I'll get money. It's my good fortune to have traveled to the same hall, Chicago, where Swami Vivekananda gave that speech. Now, you see, that is a Sri Sri Aurobindo. While the then Congress is asking him to, you know, be a little mild toned, because they are afraid of the British, they will take this action, that action. Sri Aurobindo not only, you know, himself is awake, he awakens the whole nation, living under the shadows of deportation, living under the shadow of the sword of the empire. And therefore, he says, we fell because of want of Shakti. We have everything, but we are afraid. Even when we go outside, I have seen, Indian diaspora wants to be cocooned in its own nice things, which is okay in a way. Okay, we have our temple, we can play Holi, we can do Diwali, but they don't voice an opinion actively. There is some kind of fear. Why fear comes? Fear comes from selfishness. And the mother said very clearly, this is something which has created a problem within India, that people are selfish. And I said, why they became selfish? Lack of a national ideal. Why lack of a national ideal? No figures whom we can even look up to. See, in politics this happened. There was a time when there were some figures people were looking up to. But over a period of time, there has been a steady decline. And what is the reason for it? One reason is, Shobindu points out, the parliamentary democracy. It kills greatness. Democracy is the perfect way to finish any greatness. And then he says, while democracy has given its gains, it has given the gains of certain degree of freedom to an individual, which is a good thing. But there are other ways to get freedom. It has given freedom against the tyrant autocrat. But it has also leveled out everything. Anyone who can dole out things, and these need to talk about it, at least start a public discourse. Why should we hesitate from saying that constitution can change? There is nothing sacrosanct about it. Why an average Indian doesn't speak about it? Why does he toe that same line? I will not touch a word from the constitution. What is, it's not Brahma's vakya. We don't treat constitution as the voice of Brahma, that we cannot change it. It's not, you know, we are talking the same language like the mullah speaks about Quran. Of course it can change. People evolve. If you say it cannot change, means we'll remain stuck in 1947. And people should be bold and courageous. Doesn't matter whether you lose election, win election. Okay, you may not say publicly before election. But obviously, when it comes to talking about it, sharing views, you should say openly that yes, there's nothing sacrosanct. Now, when you begin to stir the mind of the people with these thoughts, which are original, it should be original. Why should we have such a long, complicated constitution with clause, subclause? Actually, it is a typical British way of making you hang in the loop of laws and rules and regulations. You see, that's how they made rules and regulations. So, they can use it to convenience, to convict or to free, depending on how you play with the rules. And we have just imported it. Of course, we have changed now the name to Nyaya Sanhita, but still we are doing the same. What is the essence of law? And that's where Mother gave us a very beautiful clue. It is only in India that the psychic law can and must be practiced. So what is psychic law or rule of life? Is dharma. India should have its own constitution, if you want to call it constitution. Or you simply say dharma samvidhan, dharma sanhita. You don't have to take up Manu or Raghunandan or, you know, what was he? Vadrayan. So don't have to take that. Devise your own. What does your inner sense tell you? Does it not tell us that, well, you don't misbehave with a woman? Do we need complicated laws to say if she says no, it is no? It's very simple. Where a woman is not respected, isn't it there in our scriptures? That place is bound to be doomed. Somebody may say, once someone asked me, what about Islam? It doesn't respect women. I said, paradoxically, it may sound. It has its own way of respecting. But given that fact, yes, it doesn't. And it's bound, it's doomed. When will it be doomed? Look at the civilizational curve. This is important to understand. Christianity is about 2000 plus years old. Right? If you take from the era AD, we are in 2024. Islam is about 1600 years old, 600 AD if you take 1400, 1500 years old. Sanatan Dharma, thousands and thousands of years old. Buddhists, we have gone through these curves. They are going through these curves. Civilizations go through hundreds of years. Like if we look at today's Islam, it is much like medieval Christianity in the 1300, 1400 AD. Exactly like that. maybe a little better for all you know. If you look at Christianity at those days, so much worse with all the inquisitions, anybody, I mean, we are talking about the Waqf Act. Till about 100 years, less than that, 70 years back in Goa, there was a similar act by the Christian, I'm sorry to say, because Christ is wonderful, but churchianity, I mean, it's a word which has been, if you look at it, that anybody could say that Mr. John, who is a convert today, is practicing basically Hindu religion at his home, and your property could be usurped, even a dead man's property could be usurped. This was the rule. So what is the difference? But slowly over a period of time, faced with the challenge of life, they evolved. So that challenge has to be provided. Islam needs to be challenged, both at every level. And if we don't do it under this false bhaichara, enough of it. Bhaichara is very important. Brotherhood, we'll come to that. Brotherhood simply means that we are children of the same mother. There cannot be brotherhood if you try to kill your own mother. That would be very strange, that brothers met together and they killed their father and mother, but they are my brother. That's a very strange doctrine. There is no family without the parent. Sometime back, somebody had written something about Sri Aurobindo and the mother, and I was very vocally, I had written, and I was asked that, don't you think we are a family? I said, yes, a family, but in a family, nobody mistreats the parents. And if you mistreat the parents, no more a family, it collapses. Logic is very simple. You have no family without mother and father. So, father they have fixed, unfortunately. And I keep saying this, time we should change all this mindset. Who is the father of the nation? Of course, Ram and Krishna, if you want to put it. Who is the mother of the nation? Bhavani Bharati, she is the mother. Mother Durga. Why should we be afraid of these symbols? We are afraid even of saying Bande Mataram. It will hurt somebody's sentiment. But my sentiment, if it is hurt, it's okay. Because, you know, I am supposed to be hurt. This playing the martyr, that's not what sacrifice means. Sacrifice means purity, growth in strength. People who know to sacrifice, they don't sacrifice at all kinds of altar. It means sacrificing the ego for a greater good. So awakening of Shakti is so important. Every child in every school should be taught martial arts, fencing. It brings that sense of power inside. It makes you feel that this is my culture is not just about doing pranam, touching the feet of elders, doing Jairamji ki, which is all okay. But my culture also teaches me that if necessary, all women should learn, men should learn. I don't think it is taught. We are taught cricket. Football. What is cricket and football? So these are some of the elements. Parliamentary democracy, Sri Aurobindo very clearly said, that's not what he prefers. So, of course, now the conditions have changed, so you can't have the king. So what should be practiced now? He said one is a kind of a federation where there is more power to the village samitis, village, even panchayat. And every little village should have its power to have its own rules and regulations based on its own needs. You see, it is such a far-seeing thought. People say demographies have changed. Villages have become, some other religion have occupied. Why? Because people there living there felt it doesn't concern me. They never felt it's my place. Why somebody is deciding from the center? They cry later on. But if you have the power in your hands at the level of the grassroots, then people think, look here, this is happening. This is not quite right. See, UP, in this election, one thing which UP has taught us, that local issues matter. Empower people. At the same time, you have a federation. And at the top, something like a Rashtrapati with much more powers. And he stays a stable term. This is what Sri Aurobindo's, something like the US, but better than the US in many ways. Even in US, they have given, there is an autonomy to the states to regulate their laws. It should be much greater. So village autonomy should be there. Autonomy in the sense of framing every village. Then you will see the diversity of culture being preserved to any extent. Diversity is so important. And with regard to Islam, we should be vocal in UN and everywhere that look here, if we talk about preserving cultural diversity, this is the danger, very openly. So this is where Shobindo says that parliamentary democracy is not something which is good, but he also says we have to go through this phase, and before we get constitution, does need to change, it should be more, doesn't matter what word we use, it should be aligned with the spirit of dharma. And we have enough of, we don't need to transport Manusmriti. By the way, if people read Manusmriti, it's not something as evil as it has been painted. But yes, it is contextual. It is relevant in its own time. And we need not follow that. Even the caste system should go. It has gone. Time spirit has broken it. Shri Krishna himself has broken it. Why? Because it became surname oriented. Caste was not based anymore on the inner power. But the truth of caste system will remain. There will be people who are there to preserve the knowledge in this world. There will be people who will be there to be born leaders who are meant to protect dharma. And these things should be encouraged, should be more and more brought to the forefront. And third thing which he said, there is no, you cannot do all this unless there is a national education. So national education is a very vast subject, of course. National education is not just teaching our scriptures, which is okay, important. But national education means preparing the national mind the way it was done at some point of time. So what was our way of life, if you look at it? What was a student supposed to do or meant to? If you look at it, it was brahmacharya ashram, self-discipline, self-mastery, self-control, as during child and adolescence was emphasized. Because it was the in thing. Everybody accepted it. We also accepted when we were children. But now that has been broken. Broken by what? By woke culture, as simple as that. And we are reaping its evil fruits. Now you tell the children, no, you know, you have to observe discipline and you can't carry cell phone. Oh, you are against freedom. But if you explain that freedom is self-mastery, if you don't have discipline, there is no freedom. You are a slave. But all this, who is going to say? We have just adopted that system. Of course, there is no question of beating and all that. That is cruel. I mean, that makes the consciousness hard. But certain degree of self-mastery, self-discipline, through various means, the aspect of brahmacharya is completely missing. Another important element that Sri Aurobindo says, how will we win back our olden glory? He says, we are afraid of thought. Use the word thought phobia. He says, we must come back to original thinking. Original understandings, little bit it has started. Original understanding of things. But we are too busy preserving only the old. No, no. Why? Because Pandit has said so, because it is written there. No, there should be an original thinking. It should be allowed. And we should be ready to think, debate, not just on TV, but within ourselves. He speaks of those reforms which are necessary within the Indian society. So these are some of those things that Sri Aurobindo speaks. And most important is spirituality is its backbone, Indian thought. That, of course, is still flourishing. But spirituality is nothing if it is not made alive by living it. Creativity should be encouraged. And living spiritually, not just a few Sadhu Baba. So there he says that two kinds of things happened. One was the masses on one side became very irreligious because they were never included as part of the mainstream spiritual life. Now this movement has started in some way. Nobody asks you before you enter into a spiritual this thing, what is your caste? So it's a nice thing. In a way it is generalizing things. Also many developments have taken place, like such forum. So you don't do that. The second is still this respect for ascetic kind of spirituality. It is very appalling. Honestly, that, you know, as long as we respect Gandhiji and as long as we pay lip service or whatever service to the Shankaracharya, they are great, all right. But we must have the power to even challenge. I have seen people have come and even almost somebody was ready to have fist-to-fist fight. Why? Because you have to accept Shankaracharya. I say, I accept him, but he has his own place, that's all. You can't blow him out of proportion. He has his place. Nobody can deny. Everybody has their place. But when you make him as the leader of the Indian spiritual or religious and try to justify in some way, even the other day I was seeing a debate discussion going on. I won't name, but two stalwarts of Sri Aurobindo's yoga philosophy or whatever you may say. So one is talking about the Vedanta of Ramanuja and Vedanta of Shankaracharya vis-a-vis Sri Aurobindo. Why do we have to do this? Why do we need to this kind of desperate preserving and respect for the past? Everything has to be. Why can't we come out with a fresh stream? I mean, when I look at Mother's prayers and meditations, I have shared this. If you look at it from a bhakta's point of view, it goes far beyond Narad Sutras. It goes far beyond Shandil's Bhakti Sutras. It goes far beyond the Bhakti movement, all the Bhakti saints. I'm saying this with, I should not use the word, but some authority on this. When you look at her Bhakti, it is something which has never been expressed. Maybe it has manifested in one odd someplace. Look at what we do to Radha on the television serials. Radha is a grand culmination of surrender to the Lord. And we turn it into a street romance. And in films, of course. And we are so happy. Catchy tunes. So we should be, it's a massive work to be done. And two things which Sri Aurobindo insisted on is awakening the Brahma Tej and the Kshatra Tej. Brahma Tej doesn't awaken by reading scriptures alone. Brahma Tej awakens when we have this burning aspiration, flame of aspiration. I want to know the Brahma, not just think about it. It should become my reality. I must know what is that which they call as Brahman. Not debate and discuss. Is it same as Tao? It is same as... It doesn't matter what you call. I must discover. Then Brahma Tej develops. Tej is what? It's that radiance, that light. One grows into that light as the flame of aspiration ascends from plane to plane. And similarly, Kshatra Tej. It's no point just fretting, fuming and saying, I must do this, I must do that. Face the danger. And even, of course, that's an extreme step, I know. won't happen. Because nowadays we talk about sovereign territories and all. I said, you are asking people from Bangladesh to enter India, ask Indians to go. There is a porous border. Go there and protect the Hindus if you are really keen. Reinforce it. Nothing wrong. It's dharma. There are people who are being helpless victims and one should go and support. I'm not saying occupy a territory. Come back if you need to. But that is the kind of action. And that people understand. I used to often wonder that why is it that, M population is everywhere. Why in certain countries they remain in check? See, why they want to change the demography? Because their strength is in numbers. They want to have more. But when they know that they will get a backlash. See, what happened in UK? Is there a talk that, there is civil war and all this going on? No. The Brits have come up with heroism, manhood, courage. And they are giving a pushback. That's the right way. So all this, I'm keeping the Bangladesh context in mind. Heroism must awaken, Kshatra Tej must awaken. To awaken it, things which are typical of Kshatriyas, warcraft, all this should be taught, children should be exposed to it. Let's be done with, politics of Mughal Empire and its architect. Let's teach them the glory of Shivaji, Maharana Pratap, again national education, all this. So there is a great work to be done and time is always short. But I'll just read the cause of India's decline. And Sri Aurobindo says, it was because their public life became most irreligious, egoistic, self-seeking. It looks like he's talking of today. An average Indian, the fact is extremely selfish. He will vote either for caste benefits. Why caste? Because somebody will give them doles. He is sold out for a television. I told this, some Delhi people were talking to me. I said, you people, you sell your soul for a television and wine and rice. You talk of manhood. So we need to make it, show the mirror. We are blaming the politicians. What about those people who are buying this stuff? Materialistic that they fell. Even today, average Indian marriage, ladka kitna kamata hai? NRI hai kya? NRIs have run away. Back to India, some NRI. No, but isn't it so? Am I saying something which is wrong? Average, typical. How much is the man, boy earning? He may be a scoundrel, an extremely selfish person. Where do they get these ideas? From the house. So, you know, we need to, he's selfish, egoistic. Mother said one of the main causes for India's fall has been selfishness. We don't want to see it. It's there. It's there, got into our bones. And I said the reason was, of course, a certain mainstream was excluded from this spiritual awakening. The masses have to be included in this spiritual awakening. That's what I was sharing mother's experience. That, you know, spirituality has to become by its very nature more and more collective. It is possible that on one side we deviated too much into an excessive religiosity. That is to say, an excessive externalism of ceremony, rule, routine, mechanical worship. Yesterday one child was asking me about fasting. So I said, how does fasting help? I said, it makes you reduce your weight. No, it is there. And I said, okay, tomorrow, next time you come with all the quotes from the scriptures where all fasting is mentioned. I said, I can tell you about Gita that it speaks about moderation. Buddha speaks about moderations. The Upanishads don't say that by fasting you are going to make spiritual progress. Where did it come in? It came in with whatever reason, but don't perpetuate it. One doesn't become a good wife by doing that Karwa Chauth and getting some gift from the husband and whatever. I mean, one night I'll pray for you. I mean, we should understand. If you want to do it, do it. But that's not what is important. A Hindu is Hindu. If a woman like Savitri stands up, he says, I'll defy death. A man like Rama walks all the way to Lanka. That is the Hindu. So he says that it's possible. Rule, routine, mechanical worship. On the other, into a too world-shunning asceticism, which drew away the best minds who were thus lost to society, instead of standing like the ancient rishis as its spiritual support and in illuminating life givers. But the root of the matter was the dwindling of the spiritual impulse in its generality and broadness. Spirituality which is applied to every sphere of life. The decline of intellectual activity and freedom. The waning of great ideals, the loss of the gust of life. So these are, Shobindo speaks about, and he says that we have to revert back to the earlier truth. He speaks about Kali Yuga, in which a lot of destruction take place. And we should not try to just save the platform, but learn to construct new. Why does Shobindo face so much resistance? I have not understood. One reason is only we are afraid of the new. And this is spiritual new. This Shobindo is not teaching some. He's teaching of the deepest, highest, fuller truth of spirituality. But see the resistance. Why? Because it's not deviating from your understanding of Vedanta. I won't even say Vedanta. So people don't. Are you? Let it be so. It is something great, beautiful. See whether it goes with your own inner aspiration. So this is where we began to. And then he says, ancient Hinduism aimed socially at our fulfillment in God in life. Modern Hinduism at the escape from life to God. Even now you will see, I have seen people actually, and I don't want to name, who have gone to these monasteries, ashrams, where ascetic ashrams, given away all their jewelry, very expensive things. Said, we gave away to the Swamiji there. I said, for what purpose? Swamiji should not be needing it. No, he has to feed the people inside the ashram. I say, strange logic, is it? We do this. We go to the temples, we'll give that kind of daan. But to use money to create beauty in the outer life, that something escapes us. Why is Matri Mandir? Somebody asked. Couldn't that money would have been used? Someone asked me once, that could have been used for feeding the poor. I said, yes, and they would remain poor forever because you are feeding them. But this is the symbol of the divine perfection in material life. Create something like that, that people remember. Mother created not just one, several structures. One is the Matri Mandir, second is Golkund. Many people don't know. Golkund is an amazing work, yoga in the material world. But this divorce between material life and spiritual life, it has gone too far. And I think the time has come to very, very clearly and categorically say that, well, this is not what we as Indians want. People can practice. It's their business. I'm talking of generalizing this ideal. This is a false ideal. This can be an individual ideal. You can practice ahimsa. You can practice organics. You can practice shunning milk. It's your business. You can take goat milk all your life. That's your problem. But for God's sake, you can't put it as a national ideal. So, every time I speak, Satish, sorry, in this forum, my heart pours out because it bleeds, especially when it comes to India, since you have given me free rein. Yes, there is so much to change, so much to do. Where do we begin? With that, we can close. Living these ideals. Realizing them. Enough of talks, enough of discussions, enough of debates on which Vedantic system is better. Discover the Vedanta in life and it will be fascinating. For example, people still don't know that if we, or God is all, everything is in God. So you see, tolerance, they don't know. They don't understand that, you know, tolerance, you are importing a foreign word. It's a virtue. Vedanta is not about virtue and vice, not about good and evil. All is one. So, you know, everybody is my brother. Sri Krishna, Yogi Yogeshwar, is asking Arjuna to fight against the adversary. Why? In action, it is dharma which counts. We have forgotten dharma. Dharma is the guide to action. All is one. So I don't fight with vengeance, hatred, anger, all this I should not. Jealousies, or fear, all this should go away. But dharma I must fight for. And lastly, we are a very divided lot. Unity is one thing which will save us. What has till now saved the Mohammedan is this phenomenal unity. Yes, they are divided inside, they may fight. But when it comes to anybody else, they stand united like a flock of wolves. Yeah, because they are not lions. No lion deceives, no lion stabs you behind the back, no lion runs after minority. I mean, this is nonsense. Yes, like wolves, in a pack of wolves. That's how. But it's a strength. Unity is strength. That they have understood. We have not understood. And we succumb to all the divisions. And you see, you can't heal divisions by catering to everybody. Like Muslim appeasement, you will divide it further. Appeasing the Dalits, you will end up creating division. Fissure more and more. Caste, appeasing one caste over another. You practice the true equality which, you know, is enshrined in the constitution. Then unity will come. It'll take some time. Some people will grouse, initially grumble. But then people get used to these fissure lines are not there in let's say, in American, this thing. So how do they manage? They manage. People have accepted it. Well, that's how the constitution is. I will not be given a special quota. Now woke culture has brought it because it's disintegrating force. It's a disintegrating force. If you bring in casteism today and start favoring this and that, however it may, it's very appealing. So it is going to be a disintegrating force. So unity is so important. The only way to bring unity is not through caste, obviously, not through different sects, but by the nation's soul. Bande Matram, that we are children of the same mother. We may be Mohammedan, Hindu, Christian, everything, it's okay. But our identity is as a Bhartiya, an Indian. Very proudly we should proclaim. And I have seen it, as of course I have been fortunate to be visiting every state of India I have gone, and also been in the Indian Air Force, posted to several places. And whenever people asked me, even in ashram, they would ask me, where do you belong to? I said, Bhartiya? Indian? No, no, that is okay. I said, no, that's not okay. Don't ask me the next question, whether I am an Odia or a Gujarati or a Bihari or a Bengali. I am an Indian. This sentiment should go across, that we are all children of the Divine Mother and children of Ma Bharati. And in our life, in our greeting, we should simply say, Bande Matram. Even if the constitution doesn't approve of it, even if the parliament is afraid of saying it, if we can't sing it in schools, let's start a movement of greeting each other, Bande Matram, whenever we meet, because we are children of Mother India. And Bande Matram for us, we are not only children of Mother India, we are children of the Divine Mother, and this mantra has been given a life by none else but Sri Aurobindo. So for us, Bande Matram is a very, very special mantra, and we should use it wherever we go, whomsoever we meet. I think that's enough. Bande Matram.